Welcome to Drilling Deep. I'm your host, John Kingston. And here at Drilling Deep, we talk about oil and diesel. The latter comes from the former comes from the ground, and you have to drill for it to get it. So that's why the show is called Drilling Deep. We also have a guest of the week. This week, it's Laura Rainier of Gartner. Gartner is a technology consulting firm. They also run this big Gartner Supply Chain Symposium, which I attended last month. I will tell you that she talks about something kind of very geeky, Scope 3 emissions. And while she doesn't come right out and say it, I will tell you right now, if you don't know what Scope 3 emissions are, and you think that it's never going to really impact you, and you can just avoid the whole issue, you could not be more wrong. This is going to impact you, and you can get informed on this issue by listening to Laura. I thought we'd sort of hopscotch through some oil news because there isn't really one big thing that jumps out at me regarding the market right now. So scanning the globe, here's what I can tell you. U.S. inventories of ultra-low sulfur diesel this week are really still too tight for this time of year. They are up a little over 9 million barrels from where they were a little more than a month ago. That was at a very low number, less than 100 million barrels. But if you look at where they are compared to the last 5 or 6 years for the fourth report of June, they are very, very low compared to the five-year average, which is what most comparisons usually are measured at. Now, part of the reason this they're very low is because we had this big giant surge in 2020. But even if you throw out 2020 and use the last 6 years minus 2020, there's still about 90% of normal. And that number includes last year when they were really, really low. So we are now going to into our second consecutive winter and harvest season with tight diesel inventories. If you're a consumer, it is something to be concerned about. Moving on around the world, water levels on the Rhine River in Europe are getting really low again. The Rhine is a key waterway where gasoline and diesel barges move up and down to supply Switzerland, Germany, and the Netherlands directly. When the water levels are low, like they were last year, it limits the amount of diesel that can be placed on a barge and sent down or up the river. This is generally seen as bullish because anything that limits supplies is going to be affected. But there's also the possibility that U.S. exports to Europe may be affected because if you can't move it down the Rhine into the interior of Europe and you can't move it to those end users, then what is the point of exporting it? I do think the Rhine levels are more bullish than bearish, but it's another factor that could impact diesel markets in coming weeks. Remember, the fact that you're in the U.S. is irrelevant. Diesel markets are global, and an impact in one place has ripple effects elsewhere. Then we've got the crude oil supply-demand situation, or the balance, and the price of oil, the price of crude oil, which is really spitting in the face of OPEC plus reductions in supply, and on top of that, the looming cutbacks by Saudi Arabia, on top of what they already were contributing to the OPEC plus reductions. When OPEC plus in early April announced reductions in output that were to begin May 1st, and had begun, the price of crude was just under $80 per barrel. The Saudis then announced their own cut, about 1 million barrels a day. On Wednesday, the price of crude, as measured by the global benchmark Brent, was down to less than $73. So we're down about $7 to $8 from where we were before these cutbacks, so there's really been no impact. The argument here is that the group is playing the long game, and that unless there's a significant recession, the supply-demand balance, so the supply-demand forecast for the rest of the year looks pretty tight. Let's note that the weekly statistics from the Energy Information Administration that came out this week had a big drop in crude of about 9 million barrels in 1 week. That's a big decline for 1 week. Could this be the start of the great rebalancing and the tighter market that comes, the tighter market that has been predicted? One other thing to note, the U.S. government has been selling oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve now for several months. This is not the oil that the Biden administration released last year when Russia invaded Ukraine. That program is over. Instead, these sales are part of a longer-term sale that was authorized in the last year or two of the Obama administration. But those sales are over now, and that crude has been a bearish factor. But now you have to take it out of the equation. Most of the market bears are relying pretty much completely on the idea that global oil demand is soft and likely to be softer. They point to projections of a possible recession and the reality that China is not doing the big post-COVID rebound that a lot of people thought they were going to do. The bears are not really talking about excess supply on its own because the outlook for supply and demand looks pretty bullish. That's your summary of a few things going on in the oil world here as we approach the start of summer.
Time to move on here now on freightways. Scope 3 emissions proves to me that anybody in the logistics business who thinks that they can hide from the growing environmental pressures and ESG, they're just fooling themselves. You're probably wondering what Scope 3 emissions are. Here to talk about it today on Drilling Deep is Laura Rainier. She is a senior research director in the talent and sustainability practice at Gartner. Gartner is a research and consulting firm with a particularly large presence in logistics. I became intrigued by their work with Scope 3 emissions at their recent supply chain symposium in Orlando. I did not hear Laura speak, but I did hear one of her colleagues speak on this issue, and I knew right away that I wanted to get that speaker or somebody from Gartner, and we've got Laura here, to talk about Scope 3 emissions on Drilling Deep. So, Laura, welcome to Drilling Deep.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Okay, first thing, define Scope 3 emissions.
Yes. Well, Scope 3 emissions comes from the Greenhouse Gas Protocol. So the Greenhouse Gas Protocol is the global standard for measuring our greenhouse gas emissions in our supply chain. Essentially, you might have heard of that as referred to as a carbon footprint. And so our Scope 3 emissions are all of the emissions or the carbon footprint that occur in our value chain, in an organization's value chain, both upstream emissions and downstream emissions. So some of the biggest contributors to Scope 3 emissions for most companies with the supply chain are coming from purchased goods and services, right? The things we're buying, use of sold products, meaning the things that we're selling, right? And the ultimate downstream impacts associated with that. And of course, transportation and distribution.
So Scope 3 emissions might be, let's say you're a manufacturer of widgets and you've got a highly efficient, energy efficient operation and you use suppliers who are all highly efficient. But then it turns out that some of your suppliers maybe get their electricity from some really dirty coal plant. That impact is going to affect your total emissions, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So Scope 3 emissions are not, I came into it a little confused. I thought that Scope 3 emissions were from that sort of second level down. So there's you as the first level. I guess really the second level would be your direct suppliers. And the third level would be the suppliers to the suppliers. In fact, Scope 3 emissions include all three levels.
Yes, really. Scope 3 emissions are anything that you might have an impact on. And so if you're an auto manufacturer and you're purchasing steel, right, that all the way up to the kind of mining of metals is going to be part of your Scope 3 emissions. Organizations will scope their Scope 3 emissions differently. But generally, we'll be looking at that full value chain impact.
Now, are we at the point where if I wanted to know, we'll call my company Kingston Widgets. If I wanted to know Kingston Widgets' Scope 3 emissions, would all my suppliers down the line probably have that information? If I'm looking, I'm not sure how it's measured, you know, tons of CO2 emitted into the atmosphere every year. If I'm supplying Scope 3 emissions data up the chain, how is it measured?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think initially it can feel pretty overwhelming. So Scope 3 emissions are reported as carbon dioxide equivalent. So we're typically looking at something like metric tons carbon dioxide equivalent, but the data that we use to get there can vary, right? We can use specific data on energy consumption. So your widget organization might ask your supplier and their supplier and so on, all of the energy consumption that is taking place in their operations and then allocate a portion to you. But we can also use things like economic data, right? How much are we spending to estimate our emissions? We can also look at activity-based data, so mass or volume, to start to estimate those carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. So these approaches kind of vary in terms of their accuracy. And importantly, they can ultimately vary in terms of your company's ability to take action to impact the numbers. So for example, if I want to reduce my emissions using a spend-based method, the main lever I have, right, is to spend less, not necessarily, always the easiest activity to take on. So really important to ensure that the data strategy, the way that you're asking for data from your supply chain, strikes that right balance between scalability and accuracy.
I mean, what really strikes me now is that there there's a divide, and maybe I'm wrong, there's not a divide. My guess is that there are a lot of companies out there, not just in the supply chain, but in business in general, who think that maybe this is a fad, maybe they've got some political opposition to it, but that if you're in business, and you've got people you're doing business with, and that's everybody, it's going to be very difficult to stay away from this. You're going to have to really know what your carbon footprint is, because even if you don't care what the footprint is of the people you're dealing with kind of like on the way in, you're very likely to have to be able to provide that information on the way up the chain to your ultimate consumers. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing, you know, a lot of momentum around, you know, organizations reporting on their greenhouse gas emissions because their customers are asking them to. So their B2B customers are often asking for this type of data. So even if it's not part of your values, you know, certainly starting to become required as kind of being a player in a major value chain.
I mean, let's point out here that the requirement is not really coming from any kind of government mandate. I mean, maybe it will eventually. Maybe if you're in a place like California, it might be. Certainly, a lot of companies are dealing with you know, carbon regulations out there, but not all companies are. So this really is, I don't know if I want to call it a bottom-up or top-down or sideways in, but I mean, if a company, a major company that you're doing business with that you don't want to lose as a counterparty is requiring this, you're just not going to be able to sit on the sideline.
Yeah, I think we're seeing some regulatory momentum, right? Some kind of activity happening at, for example, from the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. So if you're a public company, there might be an expectation that you'll need to provide some of your Scope 3 emissions data down the line. That still remains to be seen, and I think we'll find out more later this year. But certainly some activity in Europe as well. But the key driver, and it shows up in our data, the majority of organizations report that they are taking on and starting to build a strategy around Scope 3 emissions because of their customers' requirements.
Right. And so, yeah, and some customers will have management that's extremely devoted to this and consider it a major goal. Others might be going along just to go along, but it doesn't matter. The information would still be gathered.
Absolutely. And, you know, regardless of their motivations, I think many of them do see the overall operating context shifting, right? And so, and they're global organizations in many cases that are requiring these things, right? So if you have operations in a place that is subject to some of these laws, you're looking at building a global strategy to address it, to get ahead of, you know, some of those other areas that might be a little bit behind.
Yeah, let's talk about the presentation I saw at the Gartner Supply Chain Symposium. It was given by your colleague, Jose Reyes. Not to be confused with the former Mets shortstop, but obviously good enough that I was intrigued by it and wanted to discuss it. Is Scope 3 emissions kind of the scariest in the sense that it's kind of so far removed from your business that you really have to worry whether you're going to be able to get accurate data and also that you have very little influence on it?
I think that's the big challenge, right? Those are the two big challenges around Scope 3, right? You as an organization are really required to drive some progress and to influence emissions that you don't necessarily own, right? That you can't directly impact. And so it's a lot of, you know, using the right incentives, right? That said, there's a lot that organizations can do when they look within. Right. If they look within their own procurement practices or their own contracting behavior, their requirements of suppliers, Scope 3 exists because we have some influence over it. Right. And so certainly important for us as organizations to look at what can we do to drive some of this progress and to really focus where we have the most influence. We don't have direct influence, but where we have those strong partnerships, that's, you know, really important place to start.
So what kind of work does Gartner do for its clients on it? Are you recommending strategies or are you just kind of a, I'll call it sounding board, but just providing people with information on what's out there? Or are you working with them and constructing approaches to lowering the carbon footprint, whether it's on Scope 1, Scope 2, or Scope 3? Let's note that Scope 1 would be me, Kingston Widgets, right? Scope 2 would be my direct suppliers or direct customers, or I guess mostly suppliers. And then Scope 3 would be kind of out there like the electric utility, correct?
Sort of. So Scope 1 would be your direct emissions, meaning any emissions that occur on site. So, you know, if Kingston Widgets has a boiler that's operating its manufacturing facility, any of the fuel consumed in that boiler is your direct emissions. If you own a truck, that truck's emissions are your direct emissions. But actually, Scope 2 is any of your purchased energy. So that, again, that Kingston Widgets manufacturing facility probably uses electricity. Your Scope 2 emissions is actually your electricity. Your purchased electricity emissions. And then Scope 3 is everything else, all of the upstream and downstream impacts.
Well,
now, Yeah.
So if I made my widgets from plastic and I had to buy X number of tons of plastic, the footprint of that plastic supplier would be a scope three emitter?
Correct.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So anyway, back to my earlier question. So what sort of things does Gartner do for their customers in the world of scope emissions?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, one of the big things we'll do is just kind of help to frame a strategy around how do we begin to get our arms around it, right? So really giving our clients a sense of, you know, hopefully a little bit of ownership, right? What can you do to get started? And so, you know, I tend to say that first step is really building a baseline, and it's not a one and done. It is kind of an iterative approach, but starting to determine what are the key drivers of impact, right? What are the big things that are likely, you know, material to my overall emissions impact and my scope three footprint, and starting to gain better data, right, where it really matters. So we can support them to kind of determine a strategy around data. And then we can start to help them determine what are those levers of impact, right? Depending on those key drivers, where can we take action, right? So it might be, you know, in a transportation context, looking at what are the optimization opportunities? How do we optimize the network to reduce emissions? Or how do we determine perhaps opportunities for shifting modes or shifting vehicles, right? And then ultimately, we help them to determine, like, what are the things that we should be doing today? How do we build that into a roadmap over the long term? And how do we then, you know, structure that vision to 2030 or 2050, you know, depending on kind of the term of our goals. So really supporting clients kind of throughout that path.
Are you getting calls from potential clients who say, look, I really don't like all this. I think it's a pain. I think it's silly and stupid, but I know I have to go along with it. So why don't you come in and help me? I'm thinking about the people who are just maybe the last resistors to this, and they're just throwing in the towel and saying, you know what, we got to do this, like it or not. So let's call Gartner for some help.
Absolutely. I think I don't always get it that bluntly, but we do get, you know, definitely, you know, clearly probably reluctant, not necessarily bought in out of passion or, you know, something that they feel their company needs to be doing out of the goodness of their heart. But I think more and more organizations are starting to see the tea leaves, right? Starting to see that this is, you know, there are increasingly requirements that are shifting them in this direction, and that it's in their interest to have a strategy around their overall value chain footprint.
And let's point out again, I think I may have touched on this, but most of this is not coming from any kind of a regulatory structure. It is coming from kind of a building business ethos. Though maybe some of the companies you're dealing with are under a regulatory regime. I mentioned California. What are some of the regulations? Where's some of the regulatory pressure coming from that might be growing vis-a-vis the amount of sort of private sector pressure?
Yeah, I think I'll maybe just kind of start by taking a giving it like a broad answer to that question, right? I think that overall, the context is shifting. And so I don't necessarily see it as, is it a regulatory requirement? Is it a customer requirement? Or is it an investor requirement? I think all of those are kind of part of the same story, right? That our customers require or recognize that overall, there are some regulatory shifts that are likely to accelerate in the future. That's why they're building a strategy, right? Our investors are looking 10 years out and saying there might be a carbon tax in the future. So, you know, we need to get ahead of this and start to have a strategy to assess and reduce our emissions. So I tend to see it as an overall kind of part of the same story. Having said that, to your point, certainly we're seeing the key driver is not necessarily regulatory requirements, right? It is that kind of overall ethos, this you know, general customer push to become a greener, a more sustainable, overall kind of responsible organization.
Yeah, we don't want to get too political here on Drilling Deep, and I'm sure you don't either, but the kind of thing you're saying is why, you know, if I hear some political leaders talk about, you know, we're really going to push back against ESG. I can't help but feel like, you know, the barn door closed. I mean, the horse is gone. This is not going to come back to the good old days. This is a standard, and companies are going to continue to follow it. You would think, you know, you never know, that there are times when maybe the costs get pretty high to comply, and they feel that there's no regulatory reason, they might back off from that. I mean, I think that's, there's always that factor too, that if the pressure gets high, that companies may back off. What do you think of that theory?
I think that you're right that the train has left the station. I think that it is
the horse on it, right?
Okay. You're right. Or the horse that the barn door is closed, or pick your expression, right? Okay. This is happening. And we are seeing it outside our windows, right? I think everyone drinks water and breathes air, right? Regardless of your political affiliation. And so, you and I, right, in the New York area, recently saw the Orange Day, right? And we're all experiencing these impacts of climate change in real time. And so I think as that happens more regularly, the stakeholder push is going to continue, right? And I think that we, and then regardless of your political affiliation, there is going to be, you know, pressure, whether regulatory, customer, or investor, to take action and address our footprint. And by the way, there's a whole lot of business opportunity there, right? So one of the regulations I neglected to mention was the Inflation Reduction Act, right? Which is not necessarily a stick, right? More of a carrot, but providing a whole lot of opportunity for organizations that are investing in solutions that are lower carbon. So I think that we're starting to see, you know, both the carrot and the stick in the regulatory and overall investor and customer environment that's moving this all, you know, towards that need to understand and address our value chain impact.
I went to the CERAWeek conference in March in Houston, and, you know, the joke down there was they should rename it Hydrogen Week. And the talk about the Inflation Reduction Act was just gushing. Because of the very, you know, they said about it was it's very simple. You know, the incentives are not some real complex thing that you need to read 100 pages to figure out, that the tax credits for producing and then using green hydrogen were really substantial. And so, you know, I just want to say that to affirm what you're saying about the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, this was a meeting of 7,000 people, and everybody was singing the praises of the Inflation Reduction Act. I do know that, you know, every company is different. The kind of business they're in differs, and the kind of things that they can do to reduce their own specific scope one emissions, or maybe to encourage the reductions down the line, all differ. But what are some of the low-hanging fruit solutions that you may have advised companies to follow?
Absolutely. So if we're thinking about transportation and distribution, you know, we typically see some of the first opportunities in that are also cost optimization opportunities. I think I alluded to some earlier around, you know, shifting modes, right? You hear a lot of, you know, shifting from air freight to sea freight, for example. And you know, things like shifting from, an often overlooked one is inland waterway, right? So shipping by waterway, particularly in Europe, you see this to be a bit more common rather than shipping by truck. So finding opportunities that are actually not costing us anything, often saving us money, but are ultimately going to be saving some emissions. Network optimization is another thing, right? Looking more strategically at where are the different nodes, the different manufacturing facilities and distribution centers in our supply chain footprint. And can we think about optimizing for greenhouse gas emissions as well as optimizing for cost, right? So starting to just kind of ensure that our greenhouse gas emissions are kind of part of the decision-making framework is a really important first step to then kind of inform decision-making in service of, you know, any emissions reduction goals we might have. I would say those are probably some of the most kind of low-hanging fruit. I think the other thing that I would say, you know, I often recommend is to seek partnerships, right? So seek opportunities to engage, not for the sake of engaging. Find those partnerships that provide really tangible outcomes, but seek ways to really align with the broader industry. And, you know, so that we're not all going to our suppliers asking them to do different things, right? We can really simplify that message and simplify that next step. That helps us build that influence that we talked about earlier. That can be such a challenge.
You know, one thing I should note, you know, I mentioned about CERAWeek and hydrogen and just the whole field. You know, I meet a lot of people, tend to be young, who are in this field, and there are some really smart people that are focused in on this. This is, you know, people can complain all they want about the government mandates or whatever, but I'll tell you one thing. I don't know how this is all going to play out, but however it does, it's not going to fail because of lack of brain power. There are some really smart people pursuing this. What would you kind of give me your comment? I'm thinking like a finger wagging speech maybe that you would give to somebody sitting on the fence and saying, you know, I just don't want to get involved in this right now. I got my business to run and I'll worry about it later. What would you say to them?
I would say, you know, those smart people, many of them are passionate and involved because they care. And I think many of them see that this is a huge opportunity. I think one of the biggest business opportunities in history. And I think, you know, if you get involved and you start to think, you know, kind of through this lens of, you know, improved emissions reduction, sustainability, we start to identify some real opportunities, whether it's cost saving, whether it's value creation. There's some opportunity here. It's not just another thing we have to do, but rather it's, I think it's a huge business opportunity and one that those smart people are getting ahead of. So I really look forward to and am encouraged by the brain power of, you know, people that are really, really working hard in this area. And that's what keeps me here, right? That's what keeps me kind of focused on this work is that, you know, I really believe there are great solutions that we just haven't uncovered yet.
Well, maybe you can talk about them next year at the Gartner Supply Chain Symposium. And I don't know if it's in Orlando again. I certainly would like to go and we'll look for maybe you to make a presentation on it. And I will be sure to be there.
I look forward to that.
So we want to thank Laura Rainier. She's been our guest today on Drilling Deep. She's a senior research director at Gartner, the research and consulting firm that has a particular focus on the supply chain. Laura, thanks again for coming in.
Thanks so much, John.
You have been watching Drilling Deep. We are part of the FreightCast family of podcasts from Freightwaves. You can find us on all the leading podcast platforms. And of course, you can find us on Freightwaves TV. I'm your host, John Kingston, and please join us again.